Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, how differently can different Zen masters talk about Zen? Can it be that different? Maybe in some ways, in some important ways. And we're going to find out more about this very profoundly from a Zen master. She's an abbess. That's kind of like, you know, men are abbess, women are abbesses in Zen. And she's written a book called Naked in the Zendo. That'll attract attention. It's the stories of uptight Zen, wild-ass Zen, and enlightenment wherever you are. So I'm so glad to be interviewing the author of Naked in the Zendo, Grace Shireson. Grace, welcome to Energy Stew.
Thanks for having me.
This is exciting because we just did a show a couple weeks ago with a Zen master who had a lot of wonderful things to say about Zen, and a very interesting guy. He's been on Energy Stew a number of times, and fascinating information. And then I read your book, and I was like, oh, this is different. And in large part because you come at it from a female point of view. And also you've had different experiences in your life that Brad didn't have. He was never, I can't say never married, I don't remember, but he didn't have children. And he's been traveling the world a lot, going to different Zen centers, as you have too. But you also brought up a family and you have grandchildren. And so there are a number of different points of view that you hold in about life because of your experiences that somebody who's not female and hasn't brought up a family might not think about in his process and the way he goes about using Zen. And I'm fascinated with your book. There's so much wonderful information, but wonderful stories in it. From the very start, how, you know, you kind of started Zen when you were very young, you know, getting off your motorcycle to go into the Zen center and, you know, very, you know, at a time in the world where it was like the new age of the, I guess it was the 60s, and we were all thinking differently in those days of opportunity. But you were kind of, you know, young and inexperienced and wanted to use Zen for certain purposes that you learned you needed to have more perspective about, right?
Yes, definitely. I was part of the hippie movement in San Francisco in the 60s and participated fully. I had a fur coat from the thrift store that I wore on my motorcycle with my miniskirt and my boots from the Wizard of Oz. So I definitely had the whole thing down. And when we went to see Suzuki Roshi in maybe 1966 or 67, he knew when he saw us what our story was. We were broadcasting the movie we were playing in. Right. And he had seen hippies before in San Francisco, and some of them stayed with meditation and some didn't. And so his approach to us was very staid and very almost withholding in a certain way, because it wasn't encouraging, come and join me, I want you to come sit with me. It was like, if you do this practice, the more you do this practice, the more you will realize that life is suffering. He used that particular expression because he saw us as fun seekers and that was the purpose of our life. So it was kind of a shock to say, this isn't about fun, ladies. This is about knowing that your life will be suffering, and how will you meet that? How will you meet the suffering?
Right. And most Zen centers are not user-friendly.
No, that's a problem, I think, because I think they could be more friendly. It's okay to be a little stiff as people come into the practice. But I think welcoming people would be a nice thing to do and not overwhelming them with rules. I mean, one of the things I tried to communicate at my own center was, it's okay if people walk on the lines between the tatami mats. We don't need to correct them the first time when they're walking in the Zendo that they have to walk over here and they can't step on this line or they break their mother's back. All of these rules that people get loaded with are a kind of ego manifestation by the experienced Zen students. And they don't recognize that really their job is to be a warm, welcoming pool that people can dive into and begin to restore themselves.
Well, that sounds good. But you've been a pioneer and an adventurer because you've gone to Japan and you meditated in a Zen monastery. That you have so many stories about that.
Yeah.
And how strict it is and crazy strict.
Crazy strict.
Yeah.
I never recommended it to anyone. I would say that when I would talk about my experiences. I don't recommend this to you. I'm just telling you what it was like and what it helped me to accomplish.
You learned a lot about yourself, not only about your limitations, because you had a number of them. For one thing, you know, in a Zen monastery, you're not supposed to be different. So you're not supposed to have your own food needs, your own sleeping needs or whatever, or even your own structurally sitting needs.
Uh-huh.
You have to be just like everybody else.
Uh-huh.
And almost everybody else is a man. So just being a woman right off is like, well, wait a minute, I can't be a man.
Yeah.
So now what?
Yeah, now what?
But
yeah.
Fortunately, you had a Roshi there who was understanding and was helpful to you, not harmful to you.
Yeah, absolutely, or I wouldn't have come. When I met him, I did sense what I was just describing, that pool of awareness that I was going to be able to immerse myself in. And it was going to be hard, but he was going to be there for me. And I didn't know all this by cognition. I felt it in my body that it was a similar experience to a meeting for Fukushima Roshi in Japan. It was very similar to the experience I'd had when I'd met Shunryu Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco in the 60s. That there was something so powerful about his teaching, I couldn't turn my back on it. And even if it was going to be difficult or mean that I had to face certain things I didn't want to face, like, wait, it isn't all about fun. Even if that was the case, I needed to do this. And I knew that in my body. And so that was why I was practicing with him, was because I sensed this about him, the power of his teaching.
And he also was flexible enough to allow you to have your own dietary needs.
Yeah, that's the power. When you're completely confident in your teaching and your ability to help people move within your teaching, then you can make exceptions. I had a separate kitchen when I had a Zen center where people who had different food needs would be able to make their own little meals.
Yeah, but that's you.
Yeah, but that I learned from him. And there's
right, yes,
a chapter in the book where he tells me not to bow. And I say, no, my knee's okay now. I had surgery, I can bow. And then he screamed at me in his loudest voice, "Don't bow!" And it hit me, and it became a really important part of my own teaching, that we shouldn't ask the body to do things that are going to harm it.
Right, and you harmed your body in Zazen, in the position of Zazen. Your knees could only take so much of it.
Yeah, that's true. And I'll tell you what, most of my colleagues in Zen over the years have these sports injuries, knee problems.
Right.
They're not alone. It's either knees or hips, but then many old people do. Our joints are not renewable resources. Right. They wear out on us, as you and I both know.
I was never able to sit in a lotus position. Uh-huh. And I studied karate as an advanced student. And all we were asked to do was to sit on our feet. So we
That's the Seiza position.
Right. And that worked for me at that stage. At this stage, I can't get into that position either anymore.
No, not so good. Not so good.
But it was a way that I could participate. And so a lot of people in Zen monasteries are forced to participate in ways that their bodies aren't built.
Yes, and the teachers seem to believe, it's almost like a religious cult belief, right, that if your practice is strong enough, it will overcome the restrictions of your body, which just is not true. And one of the problems, I think, in our whole Zen infrastructure in the United States and in the West generally, is that we believe that people who can sit in these traditional postures in full lotus are superior spiritually. No, they are superior joint-wise, right, but that does not mean that their ethics, morals, and spirituality are well-developed. This is why one of the reasons we have so many problems.
That was very clear in your book.
Yes, it is.
I know, and it's... it's so helpful. I think a lot of our audience will appreciate that, who have their own limitations, and say, well, good. I'm glad that it's not necessarily limiting my spirituality.
It's not. And in fact, I've always believed that people who come in and sit with a group publicly and require a chair have already admitted their own failure to meet the standard, to meet this golden standard. And by doing that, they're absolutely cutting into their ego activity by saying, I'm not that great at this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And that, to me, is the most powerful statement. Maybe I'm not going to be good at it, but I'm going to give it my best.
I've thought of myself as a wimp many times when I need a chair, but I don't mind it. I'm willing to be.
And it's still hard for me.
Well, because you come from having so many years of being able to fit in properly.
Doing it. And in fact, I was hyperflexible and mobile, which makes my joints suffer all the more as I've aged.
Wow. That's,
yeah, that flexibility and, getting in a full lotus was, there was nothing to, it's like crossing your arms for me when I was young. And then that pulling out of the joints has caused damage as I've aged that right. I'm now recognizing.
But I want to come back to something you mentioned about that practice can be based on ego rather than on just allowing.
Yeah, which is not giving ego such a loud voice in your mind when you just allow in your present. So you can either feed that ego or let it be. It has to be there to help you cross the street so you don't get killed. But by listening to it too much, giving it too much voice, it takes over. So when we practice, I mentioned earlier that people have take on the task of correcting newcomers because they know the rules, and that's their ego speaking when they start correcting people. It's not just to smooth the procedures in the Zendo. It's because I know and you don't, and I want you to understand I'm in a superior position. So people use the knowing of Zen protocols as an ego trip.
Well, but this comes back to Buddhist suffering. And this idea that, you have to overcome suffering to reach enlightenment. So let's see if we can help you suffer some more.
I don't know if it's that. Compassionate. Now, I'm not sure if it's that compassionate or if the first thing isn't just an automatic. Sometimes I...
Right, it's the ego.
Yeah, it's the ego leaps up first. But the Buddha's teaching on suffering is that we can't avoid it. And I think one of the modern translations of that is we can't avoid suffering because we have a body, we have relationships, and we live in a world. So there's suffering. But how do we not make more? And that to me is the most important thing.
Right. And so much of your book is really important in its seeing the big picture of society and gaining, let's call it enlightenment, to really be there with others and to see how we can make progress in society and the universe to bring it all forward. And I think that's really, you know, that's important. That's like what Siddhartha's mother was about, and his wife. They established centers for women that had to do with community. And what you're talking about is community and really being there with people, helping people relate positively and in ways that are difficult sometimes, because you've had tough times. You've been hated.
Yeah, it's not that hard when you're a strong woman. You can get hated fairly easily. You see that now with the politics, right?
Right, but there was another woman who hated you.
Yeah.
And you needed to understand how to, you know, bring that into your reality.
Yeah.
And that's really humbling in life to understand we're all different. I can't be accountable for someone else's opinions and whatever they're based on.
Yeah.
And I have to be true to myself.
Right. And I can be accountable to someone else's opinions, but I don't have to agree with them. And
well, that's right.
You know, if someone thinks I'm a jerk, that's their business.
But you do your best to be a friendly, helpful person to this.
You try, and then you say, well, this person thinks I'm not worthwhile. I think I am. And so they get to keep their opinion and I get to keep mine.
But what I like about
what I like
about your practice is that you develop that through years and years of developing more and more awareness through your practice.
Right. Yes. I believe that we can't legislate compassion or wisdom. What we can do is little by little invite awareness to be a larger presence in our minds versus coming to conclusions, having opinions, creating our own ego trips. So how do we invite awareness to have a larger space? And it's through that. And there's a great expression in Buddhism, I don't know where it came from. All defilements, meaning all problems, negative emotions, are self-liberating in the great space of awareness. So unlike other religions where we have to address our sins, in Zen, we can actually create this space of awareness and allow the problems to circulate and dissipate within this bigger space.
That's really important about what awakeness means. You know, it's like if we're awake, then we know when our ego is behaving, when we're in survival of our ego or survival of our souls.
Yeah.
There's a big difference.
Yeah, and we don't always know right away. And so how do we start to pay attention to, oh, my heart's beating fast. I wonder what just happened. And that's a question that I ask a lot. What just happened? What shifted my awareness, my attention, my moods? What shifted in all this to make me uncomfortable? Where did I get off the track?
Right. And you know, I'm thinking of my experience in karate. I studied under really a grand master, And he was teaching us how to use karate in life. And it was really about, you know, how do you take the next step? What, where do you win? Or where do you put your, where does your ego get involved? And you create a loss because you're not appropriate.
Yeah, right. You step off to face off in some way and create some conflict that you can't win.
So I guess the idea is to always understand from a higher place what's appropriate rather than what's a reaction.
Right. And one of the things I start the book with is Suzuki Roshi's response to my wearing dirty socks into the Zendo, which is a big no-no. And had anyone else been there, one of his students, but it was so early on in his career, he was on his own leading the ceremony, they would have told me, you can't do that. And here I was, a young bride, was I 21 then, maybe? And I was, it was my wedding day, and he looked at me, looked at my dirty socks, and kept his mouth closed about it. And it was only years later, as I looked back at the event with a bigger mind, knowing the rules of the Zendo, I realized, oh my God, what a faux pas, and what a brilliant way of knowing this is not the time to create a conflict and to correct.
Right. That would have
had a big mind, a very big mind.
Right. It would have been superficial.
Yeah.
For the moment.
Yeah.
There are other times when you might want to say to people, you're dirtying our
Yeah, right. You don't wear those things. You don't wear them on the street and then into the Zendo, your socks, okay? You wear shoes over them. Whoops. So that big mind to know when is the right time to intervene, I think is one of the things your teacher was suggesting, is that when, you know, you're a master in karate, that there's times when you stand up to it and there's times when you back off.
Right. And I'm just thinking recently, last year, some guy actually picked me up from the back. I hadn't even talked to him and threw me across the subway car. And it was like, I've just been attacked by somebody. So how do I want to respond to that? I was caught by passengers, so I wasn't harmed. And I looked back at this guy, he was about 30 years younger than me, and big, strong guy, very happy with himself that he got some anger out about something, not, you know, and used me. So I knew I had to do something just to feel balanced about it. And instead of thinking I could fight him or anything like that, I just walked up to him, looked him in the eye and said, that wasn't very nice. And all he could do was kind of go, and it was all over.
Yeah.
You know, I defused it. Yeah. And I felt, you know, I said, well, it was kind of wimpy of me, but it was.
No, you didn't slink away. You went and faced him eyeball to eyeball. That's good. I think I would have looked at him and said, ouch.
Right. That's another way
another
of going.
Response. Him. Yeah. Yeah. Like, ouch. What was that?
but that's the point is that with practice, your Zen practice and my history of working with universal realities, you learn to see the big picture. And that's why you are such a great promoter of Zen, because it really helps people understand how to live in life fully. With so much greater awareness. It's an awakening, as we said earlier.
Yeah, yeah. The most important thing is that we recognize we have ideas and then there is reality. Like you have your idea that you're not a guy to be pushed around on the subway. Unfortunately, there's a reality that somebody decided he was going to, right. So then what? And there's this great expression in Zen, the universal koan, the universal puzzle. You know, we sometimes meditate on puzzles, like what's the sound of one hand clapping? So the universal puzzle is, when nothing will do, what will you do? Nothing's going to work.
That's a great way to start to and the show, because we're getting near the end of it. And and leaving that as a dot, 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 because I think sometime soon we should talk again, because you have so much to say, and your book has so much, so many stories in it. It's full of life and reality.
Yeah.
So it'll be a joy to talk with you again about it. Uh-huh. So people should pick up this book, Naked in the Zendo. And your name is Grace Shireson, S-C-H-I-R-E-S-O-N. Is there a website or?
Yes, I do have graceshireson.com or Shireson. I don't care how it's said. We answer everything from Sherrington to Schimmelhorn. People get overwhelmed by the number of consonants. But anyway, graceshireson.com. I have a website. And when I'm not too depressed about the current politics, I'll actually do a blog. I'm in the middle of writing one now, and I just haven't been able to finish. It's just, But yes, there is information, and I will be doing a number of things like this to promote the book. Also sure. In New York.
Yeah, no, this is it's so great talking with you. I really enjoyed your book so much, and everybody should really appreciate reading it, because there's so much value to it, and as well as entertainment.
Great. I'm glad. That was the point. Yeah. Let's make the medicine go down.
That's right.
It's so fun.
So Grace, thanks so much for being a guest on Energy Stew.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening. Thank you.